heavy ion collisions, and then to sort of whet your appetite for our figuring out exactly how they work and what they do in the context of QCD, which is still an incomplete problem. So the way I think of a heavy ion collision is you take these two nuclei and you accelerate them up so fast that they become pancakes because of Lorentz contraction. And you slam them together, typically a non-zero impact parameter, so that they're going to overlap in a region which is not a disk, but is sort of an elongated disk. And then you should think of these things as each built out of constituents, which are quarks and gluons, of which there are many per nucleon, of which there are also many. And unlike a proton-proton collision, the density, there are two differences with respect to a proton-proton collision. One is that you have an area filled with these things, which is much bigger than it would be in a proton-proton collision. And the second is that the density of these things is also higher, because not only do I have many nucleons across here, but I actually have many nucleons stacked on top of each other in this direction. So I have a very high density of high-energy quarks and gluons. And they're going to scatter with each other when I collide these guys together and leave behind a region which is narrower than it is wide and, thinner than it is wide and narrower than it is long, filled with quarks and gluons moving in every random direction you can imagine, typically a few thousand of them. And the question is, what's going to happen next? And if I can think of these as high-energy quarks and gluons, then I can think of them as being fairly weakly coupled to each other. And so the leading order approximation of what they're going to do is fly in straight lines at about the speed of light. This is dangerous. They fly in straight lines at about the speed of light. And if they do that, then a funny thing is going to happen, which is called momentum segregation. So now I'm looking at that collision region edge on. So one thing was coming from over here, and the other was coming from over here. And because they were flattened into pancakes, they're going to leave behind all of their stuff in a long, skinny region here. But then since everything is flying at close to the speed of light, in a fairly small amount of time, that's going to puff out. And as it puffs out, the things which were moving forward are going to end up forward, and the things that were moving backward are going to end up backward. And that means that the only things left in the middle will be the ones which are moving approximately in plane. And so if you look at the distribution of things in the middle, you would find that rather than pointing in every direction, they were pointing almost entirely in plane. So it would be highly anisotropic in momentum distribution. And the same thing is true in the transverse plane if the collision is off-center so that it starts out with a long, skinny object. And the result is that here in the middle, I'm going to have a whole bunch of things which are mostly flying up and down. And on the edges, I'm going to have a whole bunch of things which are mostly flying to the right on this edge and to the left on that edge. On the top and bottom, I'm going to have things which are flying up and down, but that doesn't matter very much because there isn't really very much top and bottom compared to the amount of sides. So what's happened is that if nothing has hit each other, the number of things moving transverse and the number of things moving vertical is still the same as it always was. But the things in moving vertical are all in the middle, and the things moving transverse have all worked their ways to the edges here. And so then if you look at these guys in their local rest frame, then there's much more Py than Px. And the same is true in the middle, because the local rest frame is just the original rest frame. And I argue that all the guys who have Px have moved out from that region. So what's happening is that the Px is all ending up being the collective motion of groups of things. And the Py is the distribution in the motion at each location. Now, if things scatter with each other, what's going to happen is that this is going to be, scattering is a local process. This guy cannot scatter with this guy over here because they're just not in the same place. So this local distribution in the rest frame is going to even out into a spherical distribution. And that's always going to eat up Py in favor of Px. So the result is that if this initial collision was elongated and if scattering happens, then I'm going to end up with far more things moving in the x direction than in the y direction. So then when everything flies out and hits a detector, I'm going to discover that if there's a lot of rescattering, there are more things flying in the x direction than in the y direction. If there isn't rescattering, it'll be uniform. And what they observe experimentally is that there's as much of this asymmetry favor of x over y in the elongated systems as there could possibly be, which implies that the rescattering is actually quite efficient. And this is a puzzle if I believe that things are weakly coupled, or at least it's been argued. I'm going to argue that it's maybe not a puzzle, but it's been argued that this is a puzzle if things are weakly coupled. Because when you just sit down and you calculate the scattering cross-section based on ordinary, gluon exchange, and you ask, is that enough to rescatter these guys and isotropize this thing? Then the claim is, by people who have done this with some kind of a many-body Boltzmann-like real space collision kind of calculation, that normal scatterings are too inefficient to rearrange the momenta to the extent that you need to explain the flow that I was just telling you about. So one explanation of why this is so is that, well, thinking about things in terms of quarks and gluons and things that are flying in approximately straight lines is just hopelessly naive. There's strong coupling, and so what you really have is some kind of a strongly coupled goop which you don't understand whatsoever. Cross your fingers, plead ignorance, and argue that it will flow maximally. And, maybe that's even true. I don't know. But I don't think that you can argue yet that one has ruled out weak coupling, because it turns out that the calculation I just described up here is hopelessly naive. And the reason is that we've misunderstood the weak coupling physics in a way which I'm now going to explain. And the whole key is the fact that in each locality, you have this business of anisotropy, that everything is flying in a restricted set of momentum directions instead of in a spherically isotropic set of directions. So think about the simplest sort of toy picture of a system which behaves like that. And I'll think of an electromagnetic system, because QCD is just 8 copies of electromagnetism. Well, it's a little bit more than that, because there are non-abelian interactions. But the key piece of physics that I'm looking for is also true in electromagnetism. And instead of thinking of things flying in all directions in a plane, just to make the picture easier, I'll think of a different anisotropic system in which everything is flying along one line. And this would happen in an actual plasma if you started out with 2 plasmas in beams moving at each other and they interpenetrated. And this is the kind of thing that people do in laboratories that occurs astrophysically, and it's interesting. So supposing I have a whole bunch of charges of each sign, which are going to interpenetrate so that everything is moving in one direction. What's going to happen? And the answer is something very interesting. Supposing I had a seed magnetic field with a wave vector orthogonal to the dominant direction things are moving, and with a with a magnetic field which is also orthogonal to the dominant direction that things are moving. I'm going to ask, what effect does such a seed magnetic field have on all these charge carriers? So let's start out with the positive charge carriers. If they're flying into this out-of-the-board magnetic field, then B cross B says that they'll deflect down. So these guys will deflect down. These guys, since the magnetic field is the opposite direction, will deflect up. And what I find is that they're getting concentrated into this region, and they're getting depleted out of that region. And the guys on the opposite side are getting depleted here and concentrated here. So it's not changing the net charge density, but it is changing the net current. So I'm deflecting the magnetic field is deflecting the particles to concentrate the current to flow one direction between one set of layers of magnetic field and the opposite direction between the other set of layers of magnetic field. And when I follow the negative charges, they, of course, do the opposite thing. But that contributes to the same current. Now, currents generate magnetic fields. What magnetic field does this current generate? Well, you take out your right hand and you wrap it around the current, and you find that it generates a magnetic field pointing out of the board above the current and into the board below the current, which happens to be precisely the magnetic field which was responsible for this thing happening in the first place. So the result is that if I start out with a seed magnetic field, it will generate currents which are precisely the currents which will reinforce that magnetic field. And the longer these particles fly, the more thoroughly they're bent, the bigger a current that they'll give. So they'll always end up giving a big enough current to recreate and, in fact, strengthen the initial seed magnetic field. Once the magnetic field gets bigger, it'll bend the particles by more. The currents will get bigger. So this is an exponential instability. And although apparently nobody in the QCD community has known about this except for the last few years, the people in the plasma physics community have known about it since the 1950s, where it was originally discovered by Weibull. And this is a good example of the failure of communication between different fields. Okay, this is a linearized analysis. And the nice thing about linearized analysis is that since at the linearized level, QCD is just 8 copies of electromagnetism. So the fact that I made this argument in electromagnetism immediately tells you that at weak fields, weak coupling, the same thing will happen in QCD. Furthermore, this is a fast process. So let me estimate how fast it is. So the first thing to understand is that this is a special kind of plasma screening. We're used to plasma screening, but this is actually a sort of a plasma anti-screening. And it comes about because I had an anisotropic momentum distribution. I should just comment. If you had some charged particles which are coming up from underneath here, then say a positive charge in this magnetic field, V cross B would be bent this way, and then in this field it would be bent that way, and then this way and that, so it would be winding back and forth like that. But if you look here, it would be contributing a net current that way, and here a net current that way, so it would be contributing a current opposite of the one I just found. So charges flying at random angles contribute currents opposite of this one. And if you had a distribution of charges flying in every direction, then they all cancel off perfectly, and you actually don't get any current. And that's easy to convince yourself, because if you have a magnetic field and you ask, what does it do to a distribution of charges, it just takes the set of directions they're going in and it rotates it. But if it was isotropic, then the rotation doesn't do anything. So that's why in an isotropic plasma, there's no such effect. But in anisotropic plasma, there's always some choice of magnetic field which will have this exponentially growing property. Okay, and furthermore, this growth in a far from isotropic plasma is fast. So the way to estimate how fast it is first you say, well, how much does a charge carrier bend? And the answer is that, well, it has a force which is given by GV cross B, and that changes its momentum by GB over K, where this 1 over K is because that's how long it sits in a coherent region of magnetic field, which is just G times the vector potential. And that induces a current, which is the number density times the size of the change in the momentum. Everything here is moving close to the speed of light, so I don't have to worry about factors of V. And this current is important if it's as big as del cross B. And that helps me figure out for what K vectors this is an important effect. And the answer is that the K vector has to be of order the coupling times root N over P, which is the same scale as the plasma frequency scale. And the exponentiation time is given by the inverse of this wave vector, which you should think of as sort of a factor of g different from the mean density of particles. And that is fast. You should compare that to the typical time it takes for things to scatter, which involves a coupling to the fourth instead of just coupling. So there's 3 powers of coupling faster for these magnetic fields to grow up exponentially than for things to scatter in the absence of such magnetic fields. So this physics is far faster and therefore more important than the physics of scattering without worrying about these infrared magnetic fields. How are we going to figure out how this happens in QCD? Well, I'm going to ask you to temporarily bless me and allow me to make the approximation that a strong coupling is much less than 1. And this is fair if you permit me to consider arbitrarily large nuclei colliding at arbitrarily large energies. And whether it's really valid for experimental nuclei that people can actually access is a good question. Probably the answer is, well, it's very marginal. But let's go ahead and see what we can get out of this anyway. It turns out that if the strong coupling is smaller than 1, then my scattering will not be perfect, and I will develop an anisotropy in my system. And furthermore, the system will have two physical scales. The scale of the typical Dubois wavelength of the gluons, which are making up the quarks and gluons making up the system, and a somewhat longer scale, which is the scale of the wavelength of the modes, which are going to grow exponentially. And I can think of the typical guys as flying in close to straight lines, which means that I can treat them as kinetic near ballistic particles. And I can think of the long wavelength guys as classical fields because they'll be at high occupation number, and so they should behave as classical fields. And that lets me do a treatment which is called the Vlasov treatment, which is just a fancy word for a treatment of a bunch of charged particles flying in a bunch of classical fields. Okay? And it turns out that treatment is slightly easier in a relativistic system than a non-relativistic one. The thing you need to define is the net color of particles moving in each direction at each point in space. And that evolves by a sort of a downwinding term. So I saw the talk by Dick Bond yesterday, so I have another 30 minutes, right? Yeah. Okay, so that evolves by a downwinding term, which just is telling you that particles are flying, but which involves a covariant derivative, which is going to be important. And then some kind of a source, which is how the presence of electromagnetic fields are going to take an anisotropic but colorless distribution of particles and polarize it. And then this is going to give me a current, which is going to fit into the Yang-Mills equations and tell me how the fields are going to evolve. This is a nasty nonlinear set of equations. In particular, the Yang-Mills equations are fully nonlinear. And I'm interested in understanding their behavior away from weak coupling when the fields become large. Because if they're growing exponentially, they're going to become large pretty quickly. But I can do that by implementing this on a lattice, because lattice gauge theory gives me a gauge invariant way of handling Yang-Mills fields. I'm not going to bore you with the details of exactly what the numerical implementation looks like, because that's the kind of thing you should never discuss in a public setting. But anyway, it's possible to set that up. And what we find when we do so is that if you start out with very small seed magnetic fields, then they do indeed grow exponentially, just like we said. And since the exponential growth is so fast, the really interesting regime will always be the one where they've already become large. And in that regime, it turns out that the amount of energy in those soft fields stops growing exponentially and starts only growing linearly, which sounds very peculiar. What's going on? Well, what's going on, it turns out, is that the fields which should be unstable become large, and then they start non-abeliannly interacting with each other. And they start non-abeliannly interacting with the charges which are responsible for the instability. And it screws up the growth of the instability. So one way of seeing that is to realize that since I have many different color fields, and since in QCD, a charge moving through a gauge potential rotates its color, if I had some other field not shown hiding in the background at the same time that I had this magnetic field bending all of the particles, that other field could be taking these blue particles which are getting concentrated into this region and flip them into green ones. And all of a sudden, the current that I was counting on to explain why this magnetic field should grow is now a green current instead of a blue one and won't actually contribute. So this will screw up the field growth mechanism that I've been talking about. So in fact, once the fields become so large that the non-abelian interactions become important, they stop growing and they start some kind of a self-similar turbulent random behavior, which you should sort of think of as the hard anisotropic modes are pumping energy into these soft, unstable modes, which are then non-abeliannly interacting and kicking each other up to higher wave vector. And we can see that by going to Coulomb gauge and looking at what the spectrum is. So at some initial moment, that at small wave number, I have these large fields, and at large wave number, I have very little. But then as time goes by, and this is a time series, the small wave number stuff just fluctuates around. It keeps growing, but then shrinking again because they're interacting and kicking each other up to larger momentum. And as energy gets kicked up to larger momentum, it cascades to larger and larger momentum. And there's a region where it's already saturated as big as it's going to be, which turns out to be well fit by a power law, and a region where energy is still getting deposited. So this is the behavior in QCD, which is completely different than the behavior in electromagnetism. Of this viable instability in the presence of an anisotropic particle distribution. Now, what we still haven't finished doing, so here I'm to my conclusions now, is to understand what the implications are going to be for heavy ion collisions. And this really depends in detail on exactly how big these fields grow in this region and how much that causes scatterings of the hard degrees of freedom, and whether it's really substantially larger than the amount that they scatter by ordinary perturbative processes. And that's what we don't quite yet understand. But it's certainly on our to-do list. And our to-do list also involves lots of things trying to understand exactly what the implications would be for observables in heavy ion collisions. Okay, so I'm done.